Vasa. The two of them kept prowling the streets, up and down the Weerstrasse, looking for a shop named Military Curios. The rain had turned to sleet, and neither of them had eaten breakfast. Ambrose already had his mobile out, was trying to find an Uber car roving somewhere in this unlikeliest of Uber neighborhoods. "Good luck," Sigrid told him cheerfully. She kept walking up the hill, peering into one grungy shop after another. The street was chock-a-block with curio shops, tiny noodle houses, laundries, magic shops, and homeopathic medicine purveyors. Finally, she got lucky. "Found it, Chief! Number 11 Weerstrasse," she cried out, looking around for Ambrose. He wasn't there. In a mild panic, she ran back down to the bottom of the street where she'd left him, trying to make his Uber app work. "Ambrose?" she called out, tripping down the cobblestones in fog mixed with snow. "Ambrose, where are you?" She saw him. He was way at the bottom of the hill, about to climb into the rear seat of a shiny black Range Rover with blacked-out windows. She waved, and he saw her.
"Hello!" he cried out. "Stay right there. I'll come pick you up."
He climbed inside and shut the door. Chapter 21. "There it is," she said, leaning forward and putting her hand on the Uber driver's shoulder. "Stop, please. This is number 11 on the right." The Range Rover coasted to a stop outside a dingy row of indistinguishable shops. They all seemed to be falling down, yet they were crowded together, cheek by jowl.
"We found it," Sigrid said. "Can you believe it?"
Ambrose said. He had his nose pressed against the foggy rear window, and he was trying to determine which one was the tiny emporium. He could barely make out Military Curiosities on the window in peeling gold leaf. The place looked abandoned. His spirit sank as he reached for the door handle to exit the Range Rover.
"Let's go,"
his new partner said, opening her door.
"Have you got your gun?"
"Gun? Well, hardly think that'll be necessary, dear."
"Yeah, but you've got it. That's the main thing."
Ambrose ducked out of the snow and tried the front door. Locked, of course. He knocked hard 3 times with no response.
"Can't see a bloody thing in there."
"Can you see anything?"
"Yes, Sigrid."
"Junk," she said,
shading her eyes with her hands, her nose to the grimy glass.
"Wait. Someone's back there. Coming from the rear of the shop. It's an old woman. Yes, she is."
They stepped back as the old crone pulled the door open a crack.
"What do you want?"
she said in a low growl, angry and not hiding it well. She could not have been 4 feet tall, and she weighed less than 90 pounds. She had a shawl over her head, which partially obscured her sharp-featured face. Congreve bowed gallantly from the waist and said,
"Guns, madame. We're looking for guns."
Then he pulled out his solid gold pocket watch and dangled it for a moment before looking at it. She immediately stepped forward and peered up at this giant of a man.
"What kind of guns?"
My wife and I are collectors. We collect historic pistols from the World War II era, madame. Curiosities, one-offs, things of that nature, as a matter of fact. May we step inside?"
She hesitated a moment, nodded, and stepped back, making room for them to enter. Sigrid left the chief inspector to go on charming the proprietors while she had a quick look around. The single dim light bulb dangled by its cord. The light it cast was negligible, but just enough to see her way around the shop. There were sagging shelves loaded with antique weapons of every description. Swords, battle axes, knives, pistols, and rifles. All stacked on top of each other in a random jumble. A pile of defunct, one hoped, hand grenades. Artillery shells stacked like dusty soda bottles. She grabbed the first handgun she saw and held it up for the boss's inspection.
"Look, darling, over here," she said. "I think this is just what we're looking for."
Congreve excused himself and made his way through the clutter toward her.
"Yes," he exclaimed. "Ah, that's the one, all right."
Sensing the first sale in years, the owner rushed over and took the pistol from Sigrid's hand a bit too aggressively.
"This one you like?"
she said, as if she rather doubted it.
"We do," Congreve said. "What kind of gun is it?"
Don't know. Not my business.
Ah, well, whose business is it?
My son. His business, not mine.
May I speak with him?
He not here today.
Too bad, Ambrose said, pulling his billfold out and placing a thick wad of Swiss francs wrapped in a rubber band on the glass counter. I'm very interested in buying this exotic treasure.
How much you got?
Count it. I think it's 10,000 francs, madame.
Be right back. You wait here.
She glided away on tiny feet into the darkness at the rear.
Yeah, good work, that gun thing, the chief inspector said.
Thanks, you too. Shh. How good is your hearing? He whispered. 20/20.
Now, be quiet, listen.
What do you hear, Sigrid? Some kind of whooshing sound.
Hydraulic door. What else?
Some kind of deep humming. I can almost feel it.
Air conditioning. There's a sweatshop hidden back there.
But how do you... Shh, silence. Here they come. They? How do you know? Shh.
Two shadows materialized from the gloom.
Ambrose, I think it's him, she whispered in his ear. That's the man. I'm sure of it.
Sigrid froze, her fingers digging painfully into Ambrose's forearm. Surely the man would recognize her. It hadn't been that long since he'd seen her, and...
How may I help you?
The thin black-haired man said, walking behind the counter and glancing at the money. He had a skimpy black goatee that needed a trim. His mother stood behind him. She was watching their every move, dark eyes moving back and forth. Congreve smiled and placed the automatic pistol on the counter beside the money.
My wife wants to buy this one.
She has very good taste,
the man said, looking carefully at Sigrid.
How do you come by such knowledge?
He asked her, squinting in the low light. Congreve slipped seamlessly in front of her before she could reply.
So sorry. My wife is deaf and dumb. I'm Chief Inspector Ambrose Congreve, Scotland Yard. I'm the one with all the money.
Yes, sir.
What is your name, son?
Ding Wong, he said,
casting a side glance at his mother.
Oh, pleasure, Ding. So, what kind of gun is this? Looks very valuable.
Excellent eye, Chief Inspector. Extremely valuable, sir. Quite old.
Visible money always did the trick.
Oh, quite rare, is it?
Ambrose said.
Oh,
Chinese manufacture, sir. 1920s, maybe 1930s. Very limited production. Maybe even handmade, home manufacture. Very popular, 1911 to 1949, pre-war era. Used by Chinese communist soldiers. Exposed trigger, so later model. In use because of the arms embargo imposed on us before the war. 5-digit serial number on the barrel. But maybe not mass production. Chambered from Mauser 7.63mm.
Oh, very impressive, Congreve said, hefting the weapon in his hand.
Ding turned his attention back to Sigrid.
This is gun you were looking for?
Sigrid nodded yes.
Sold,
the man said, sweeping the cash from the counter into his cash drawer.
Thank you. Have to go now.
He turned and nodded to his mother, who took his place at the counter, and then headed for the rear.
Oh, hold on a second, Ding, Congreve said. There's another pistol I'm very interested in.
Another pistol, sir?
He stopped and turned around.
Which one?
This one. Congreve already had the Ruger 9mm automatic aimed at Ding's head.
Huge stopping power. Ball rounds, Ambrose said. Take your arm off. No manual safety. Striker fired. Short, light, and crisp. Trigger pull. Magazine loaded with 7 rounds, hollow points. Care to see how it shoots, Ding?
You get out of here now. Wife, too. I call police.
Good luck with that. Detective Kissel is now going to check you and your mother for weapons. If you even think of resisting, I'll blow your bloody head off. Same goes for Mommy Dearest over there in the shadows. Understand me, because I will do it.
Ding Wong's black eyes flared defiantly, but he nodded his head yes.
Pat them both down, detective,
Ambrose said to Sigrid. She moved quickly behind the counter, saying,
Hands in the air, both of you. Now, spread your legs wide. Did you not hear me? I said now. And keep your fucking hands where I can see them.
Ambrose could not help himself. He smiled at his new pupil. Chapter 22.
She's clean, Chief Inspector.
Congreve slid two pairs of plastic cuffs toward her and said, Cuff them both, please, Detective Crystal.
I found this under the mother's shawl, sir, she said, coming around the counter to hand Ambrose a very light-weighted assault rifle fitted with a silencer.
Oh, another interesting gun, Ambrose said, smiling at Ding while checking the rifle's magazine. Oh, they'll take a look. Russian-made SR-3 Vicar, fitted with a Sig Sauer silencer. Extended stock, very light trigger pull. Oh, your mother, too, has excellent taste.
The woman spat twice on the floor.
How charming your dear mother is. Take good care of this, Detective Sergeant Kissel. It's loaded with 20 high-caliber rounds set on semi-automatic fire. No safety, just point and shoot, if you need to, of course.
Thank you, sir. I've got some other. You take him.
Sigrid had the assault weapon trained on the old woman now, so Congreve reached across the glass and grabbed the suspect by his skinny neck, yanking him forward so that he was stretched forward across the countertop until his feet left the ground. Ambrose pressed the muzzle of his pistol into the soft tissue between the man's eyes.
What do you know about the death of Leo Herman?
Nothing.
Try again.
Oh, I knew him, sure, but I didn't actually kill him.
Well, Ding, I might not actually kill you.
No dice, Ding said.
And what's going on back there at the rear of the store? The detective sergeant and I want to have a quick look-see.
Nothing.
Nothing? You seem like a smart enough fellow. Did you not know that high-ranking British diplomats and metropolitan police officers are exempt from prosecution for homicide?
Bullshit.
Now listen to me, you little prick. No matter what happens from here on out, you and your mother are going to prison for a long, long time. I know exactly who you are and what you have done. Detective Sergeant Kissel can positively identify you. So, here's what I'm offering. Either you take me back there, get me inside your operations room and give me the information I'm here for, or I'll have the Staatspolizei arrest your mother and remove her to a location where I will make dead certain you will never see her alive again. How does that sound?
Bullshit.
Make a decision, Mr. Wong. Either say you'll cooperate fully with my investigation from here on in, and I'll see what I can do for your lovely mum, or say goodbye to your mother right this second and tell her you'll see her other hereafter. Pick one. That's my final offer.
Ding's shoulders slumped, and he looked over at the old woman.
Sorry, Mother.
You weak. You loser.
I will show you.
We'll be right back, dear, Ambrose said, winking at the mother as he passed her by.
It was a sweatshop like you might find in the financial backwaters down near the docks of old Shanghai. Semi-dark and dreary. 20 or 30 frantic Chinese money boys on their iPhones, moving massive amounts of currency and gold certificates around the world and back, packed inside a 50-by-60-foot freezing cold room, packed to the gunnels with mainframe computers and workstations, with 3 or 4 attractive young women running around delivering coffee and collecting trading chits. The second of the steel doors hissed open, and Ding entered the room followed by a fellow rotund Englishman with a gun in the middle of his back. The room went dead quiet.
Tell them what you're going to tell them, son. In Mandarin, so I can be in on the joke. Do it now.
Attention, everyone, Ding said in Chinese. The man with me is a British police detective. In exchange for our full cooperation, he is willing to protect us to the extent that he can. That is in case there are any charges against me or any one of you. Now, he's going to ask you some questions. Each one of you will answer truthfully and in clear, loud English. Is that fully understood? Say nothing if you don't understand. Stay silent if you do.
The room remained dead silent.
You're good, son, Ambrose said, slightly amazed at the man's sudden transformation into a serious, well-educated businessman.
I'm a man of my word.
So am I. First question. Ask him if they, or anyone they know, is aware of foreign nationals hacking into the protected private accounts of British citizens. Or primary accounts held in trust for Her Majesty's government, or for Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth herself. Tell them to raise their hands if they're aware of these recent cyber attacks on Swiss banking.
Wong translated and said,
Answer by raising your right hand.
6 hands shot up immediately. Ambrose said, "Now you 6 men, please rise and go stand along the far wall." And they did so. And Ambrose continued with Ding's translation. "Are any of you, or any that you may be aware of, working in collusion with foreign agents who may be hacking into protected Swiss bank accounts and property holdings such as gold, silver, platinum, or other valuable commodities?" Wong translated. 4 hands went up. "Please join your colleagues at the rear." Wong told them the next translation.
"There is a man residing in Switzerland with whom Scotland Yard detectives would like to have a word. He uses the codename Sorcerer. Are you, or is anyone you know, aware of this man?"
2 hands. "You two remain standing and stay where you are. Thank you. Your help will be recognized by the courts. And final question. Do you 2 gentlemen who admit to knowing the Sorcerer know the location where he can be found?"
No response. Ambrose looked at Ding.
"Tell them again."
"I'm going to repeat the question. Remember that if you do not respond truthfully, evidence will be brought against you that will result in prison sentences for not less than 20 years.
"Nothing. You've got 30 seconds to stay out of jail, starting now. 20 seconds. 15. 10. 9.
Ding Wong had started shaking and sweat was pouring down his face. As Ambrose's clock ticked down, Ding's own hand began to slowly rise into the air.
"I know who he is."
Ambrose removed his pistol from the small of Ding's back and holstered it. Then he gently asked the suspect to turn around and face him.
"Anchor, you're a much smarter man than I gave you credit for. I will need you to come with me and give your sworn testimony about any information about the man known as the Sorcerer. Detective Sergeant Kissel has already contacted local police who are on their way. They will take these men into custody. Those who cooperated will all receive due process, just as I said. Do you have anything more to say?"
"And my mother?"
I'll make sure she's well taken care of now, son. One last thing before we go. You say you know the Sorcerer. You say you know his current location. Tell me where he is now, and save yourself a whole lot of unpleasantness when we arrive at Staatspolizei headquarters."
Ding confessed, all, tears running down his cheeks. Later in the interrogation room at police headquarters, Ding Wong and his employees told Ambrose and the police everything they wanted to know. Case closed. Almost. Chapter 23. Everything was going according to plan. Hawk, a fine natural athlete, was responding brilliantly to the practice climbs and extreme physical training. Luc Bresson had put many climbers through the rigors of a major ascent preparation in short order, and Hawk was performing at an even higher level than Luc had expected, given Hawk's somewhat hedonistic lifestyle. After a week, he told Luc that the air at base camp now seemed thick and rich and deliciously saturated with oxygen. It was a good day on the mountain. Storms were expected later this evening, but for now, it was almost pleasant up at Camp Bivouac. Hawk was on his cot, reading a worn paperback book called A Purple Shroud for Dying. He was recovering that afternoon from intense physical exertion and a recurring battle against altitude sickness. Luc Bresson stuck his head into Alex's tent at 5 o'clock that afternoon and said, "Bonjour, monsieur, ça va?" Alex raised his head up and said, "Hey, Luc, what time is it? I must have fallen asleep. What's up?"
"Are you available for comms? There's someone on the camp radio who wants to talk with you. Is it okay?"
Depends on who it is. Is it Sigrid?"
"I'm sorry, no."
Alex put his head back down on the pillow and closed his eyes.
"Oh, well, she's the only one I want to talk to. Sorry. It's Chief Inspector Congreve calling. He is at the Staatspolizei building. He said it is Mont Saint-Jean."
"Oh, good. Something must be happening down there. Well, please tell him. I'll be there in 2 minutes.
"Alex."
"Right here."
"Well, I've got some very good news. We finally caught a break. A banking friend of Sigrid's, John Levin,
with Credit Suisse Security Systems, came up with the name of a potential hacking suspect. Former bank employee, forensic accountant who'd left under a cloud.
Here we go.
Right. He was running in a high-pressure secret sweatshop in Chinatown. Sigrid and I went there and managed to apprehend him. Got him to agree to cooperate fully in the investigation, as well as his entire staff.
Good for you.
Sigrid, too? You'd have been proud of her. Magnificent job. I'm thinking of taking her on as my personal assistant. At any rate, with the help of the police, we were able to extract the information we'd been looking for, the exact location of Sorcerer.
Amazing. Where the hell is that old devil?
Roughly 10,000 feet above your head. Just look straight up.
Jesus, Ambrose.
The Batcave?
Mm-hmm.
There are two entrances to the complex inside the mountain, built by Swiss engineers of the Nazi era. One of them is below the surface of Lake Zurich, 100 yards offshore and about 50 feet below the surface. The other is a secret door camouflaged by faux granite boulders. It's on the ledge where Lieutenant Christian Hartz landed after his fall, where he discovered the corpse. But just above the murder wall.
Precisely.
You're going to have to climb that bloody wall again, I'm afraid, Alex.
Lucky for us, I'm not afraid.
Luke just told me he thinks I'm all systems go, at first light.
Very good, Commander Hawk.
My assistant and I both wish you godspeed.
How's Sigrid doing?
Well, you recognize her when you get back. She appears to be infused with some new spirit. Quite phenomenal, actually. It seems as if the notion of fear has flown from her vocabulary. Ready to tackle just about anything, actually.
Is it real?
Well, I dare say it's completely real, Alex, and I'm being very serious about this, a transformation of sorts. I think she hated her job at the bank, completely unsatisfying for a woman of her intellect and aspirations.
Where's our hero just now?
She just rang to see if I'd heard from you. She's at home, praying to go out. We're meeting for dinner at Café du Jour. 8 o'clock this evening, we shall drink to your very good health. Perhaps I'll even spring for a bottle of Cristal 1953 and Beluga caviar.
So sorry to miss it.
Well, we'll do it all over again when you come home. I'm going to call her now. Now, listen, Ambrose, I cannot thank you enough for what you've done. Taking such good care of her, I mean, and cracking the case.
Thank her. I couldn't have done it without her.
Gotta run. Quickly, Alex, what are they saying about the weather up there tomorrow?
Ideal.
Meaning crap.
I guess I'll find out.
If anything drastic should happen to me up there. Well, I hope you'll...
See you soon, Alex. Take good care of yourself.
The day dawned red. Hawk started up the first face at 5. He planned to attack the face in 2 stages. The first pitch in the lexicon of ascent would end 500 feet up at a small hollow in the back of the ice floe. It was situated just beneath the large overhang on the wall he'd nicknamed the Wowie Zowie during his last climb. A gentle enough way to start, he told himself. Get loose, start looking for the zone, the mental space he needed to occupy when it all got deadly serious. Hawk was carrying a 3/8-inch climbing rope 150 feet long. In each hand he held an ice axe, a thin 6-inch pick, attached to a 16-inch fiberglass handle, and strapped to the soles of his climbing boots were his crampons. These were sets of 2-inch steel picks, 12 per boot. The front two pointed forward from the toe of each foot. By planting the picks of his ice axes with a series of carefully directed swings, then balancing on the toe spikes of his crampons after kicking them 1/2 inch into the ice, Hawk could haul himself up the sheer face of Wowie Zowie like some overgrown arachnid. It was a technique he'd used since his very beginnings in the Alps, universally known as front pointing. Instinctively prudent, he would safeguard his ascent as much as possible. Every 30 feet, he would pause to twist in a threaded 8-inch titanium tube with an eye at one end, and then clip an aluminum snap link called a carabiner through the eye. After that, it was just a simple matter of clipping the rope trailing from his waist harness through the carabiner, and up you go. 500 feet off the ground, after many arm-withering hours of battling gravity and the brittle ice of Wowie Zowie, he reached the point where the rock overhung his position like a ragged, rotten awning. He scrunched up under the overhang as close as he could get and fired in another screw. Then he leaned out past the lip of the roof, got his axes planted on the underside, and went for it. He swung out on his arms, cranked off a pull-up, and started front-pointing upward to the ledge. Once on top, he launched himself into the second stage. He was moving upward at a pretty good clip, and then he wasn't. This higher face, he soon discovered, was an infirm concoction, honeycombed with air pockets. He studied the stuff, which upon closer inspection resembled styrofoam more than ice. Not good. He took a peek below, and saw that climbing back down to the ledge would be well nigh impossible. He took a brief moment to consider his next moves. Weather was threatening. He needed to find a place to hunker down soon. So, hoping the ice would improve as he climbed higher, he pushed onward. It got worse. As he swung his ice axes over and over with burning arms, trying in vain to chop through the deteriorating ice and find something solid to sink his picks into, he found it harder and harder to keep a grip on his tools. All of a sudden, every anchor point he'd placed sheared out, and he found himself logging some airtime, as climbers called the act of falling. He hurtled upside down until the force of the fall plucked his uppermost screw out of the rotten ice like a toothpick out of a cocktail sausage. He fell past the ledge he'd just left and kept falling. He felt at that moment that he might actually crater. It was a verb he never used except when he was on solid ground, in some cheery alpine après-ski environment, sharing a laugh and a drink by the fire with a pretty girl. The phrase crater is reserved for those unhappy occasions when a climber suffers the misfortune of falling all the way to the ground. Luck, as was its habit sometimes, was on his side, because the next screw held, and he bounced to a stop on the stretchy nylon rope after falling a mere 60 feet, bruised and frightened, but otherwise unharmed. He hung there for a while, spinning lazily in space while he thanked any number of his personal deities, including his lucky stars. When that was accomplished, he started hauling up that bloody rope. Once atop the ledge, he went about the business of making it cozy. Darkness was falling, and it was futile to try and gain any more ground. If the weather held and he got an even earlier start in the morning, he felt he could reach his destination sometime in the late afternoon, if, of course, he had a bit less excitement than he'd had today. He first checked all of his gear to make sure he'd not lost something vital to his health in the fall. And then he broke out his rations. He devoured them, heated some water with his stove, and had a lovely cup of tea. He stood up and shoveled snow for a while until he'd cleared enough flat space to pitch his tent. He fully intended to enjoy his evening. It had been a long, eventful day, but he'd had far worse, far, far worse. But not to dwell upon them was the secret of sanity up here, where confidence and a positive outlook could keep you alive. He would sip his chamomile tea to settle himself, watch the red sky go to black and filled with cold, pinprick stars. And then he would read his book, and then he would sleep. The average mountain tent has about as much elbow room as your average red phone booth in London, with less floor space than a queen-size bed. Being tent-bound on a mountain isn't wholly an ordeal. The first hour or two can pass in some dreamy euphoria as you're lying peacefully in your sleeping bag, watching stars come out, or raindrops trickle down from the sky, or snowdrifts slowly climbing the walls around you. Within the realms of your tiny tent, there is an atmosphere of guiltless relief. The night has blessed you with a sturdy alibi for not risking your life for a few hours. Your life is secure for a while, without anguish or pangs of conscience or fear. There's nothing to be done but drift back off to untroubled sleep. Chapter 24. He awoke in a state of grace. He'd opened his eyes to a panoramic view of black eastern skies, fading up to faint pink. So beautiful. Even before he rolled over and looked at his watch, he knew he'd changed somehow. While he'd slept, his mind had been hard at work, teaching him, leading him back to truths long lost to him. Yesterday had been far too exciting, simply because he'd been ignoring himself, not hearing calls from some deeper region of his cortex, ignoring some old muscle memories anxious to be recalled. It had almost killed him. If that last anchor point had failed to hold in the ice, he'd have been sleeping underground, if they ever found him. If not, at least he'd have been spending eternity in the company of his grandfather. It was, he thought, actually some consolation. He knew before he'd strapped his crampons to his boots that this day would be different. He felt utterly rejuvenated. In an odd way, he was back. Once properly learned, the sophisticated techniques of climbing, like those of competitive swimmer, are never really forgotten. All he needed was to rediscover what new limitations aging and inactivity had placed on his skill and nerve, and overcome them. Contrary to common knowledge, a good climber with sufficient experience can move straight up a vertical rock face he cannot cling to. It's counterintuitive. Human nature dictates a natural desire to cling to anything solid, but a regular, predicted set of moves from one point of imbalance to its counterpoise will keep a climber close to the face, but only for as long as he continues moving with speed and grace. From a distance below, it looks like you're dancing up there, gracefully careening on and off the wall as you sprint up. It's a skill rather like that of a bicycle rider who has little trouble with balance unless he goes too slowly. All that's necessary is to first read the pitch accurately, plot out and rehearse the moves cinematically, then make every single move with smooth conviction from hold to hold. Do that, and you will arrive at the next predicted and reliable purchase, and the next. These skills and abilities had once been Hawk's forte, but during that exciting first day of climbing, he'd made several misjudgments. One that had caused him a serious fall. Others that had sent him slithering down 20 feet of scree, banging a little skin off his elbows and doing greater damage to his self-esteem than anything else. It wasn't pretty. The intervening year since his last tragic climb had eroded the fine edge of his physical dexterity. This erosion, he now realized, was beyond repair, even with Luke's valiant efforts down at the camp. Today, it would be necessary for him to systematically train himself and relearn old tricks while he was up on the murder wall. If he wanted to survive, he now had to teach himself to think within the limits of his new inferior body. He had to learn how to listen to himself. He set his first pick and hauled himself up. He was only halfway up the 24,320-foot peak. When he reached the ledge overhanging the murder wall, he knew that he might find conditions up there worse than at the North Pole. Temperatures could sink to 40 below, and the winds howled at 80 to 100 miles an hour. He knew. He'd been given a booklet by the rangers when he'd signed in for his solo climb. Insurance requirement. He'd read that the combined effect of cold, wind, and altitude may well present one of the most hostile climates on Earth. His reaction to those pre-climb caveats was to propose angrily that the rangers mind their own bloody business. Tomorrow was going to be either a very long day or a very short one, because he was no longer afraid of the murder wall. And that was the best guarantor of success that he was going to get when the sun came up. 7 hours later, he found himself still alive and happy. The murder wall had failed to kill him. The first thing he saw, heaving his body up and over the lip of the edge, was a small wooden door set in the rock, dusted with fresh snow, just where it was supposed to be. Until the second he saw it, he was not entirely confident that he'd reached his goal. Visibility was down to almost naught. His altimeter showed that he'd reached the designated altitude, but there were other significant ledges of similar sizes above and below him. This one was called Das Boot, because it looked like the prow of the massive World War II German battleship Bismarck, sticking out of the side of the mountain. The GS on his wrist said that the Batcave, if it existed at all, was very near. Reason said this had to be the place. Unless, of course, the Chinese curio shop owner had lied to Ambrose and Sigrid. The outcropping was wide and deep and very substantial. Just eyeing it by sight, he'd guess 70 feet across and roughly 50 feet deep. It occurred to him that you could easily get a chopper on and off this thing. He took a few deep breaths to get himself oriented. Out across the far horizon, a sea of ice-topped peaks. The hard part was over. The bitch had thrown everything she had at him. She'd killed his grandfather, and she'd just tried to kill him too. But this time, she'd lost. The wicked bitch was dead. He turned his attention to the escape door. Weathered by the fiercest storms on the planet for a century or more. Wide and just high enough for him to enter without ducking. At this point, he was simply looking for a way inside the rock. He was searching for the Batcave, and he was getting close. He dusted off the snow that had accumulated on his goggles and scrambled to his feet. He scanned the rocks and boulders to either side of the door and also above it. He knew what to look for. Granite 2, Blinky had called the material used to hide fighter squadrons and battalions from prying enemy eyes. "You won't even know it when you're staring at it," he'd said. If there was any fake rock on this ledge, Alex sure as hell didn't see it. And even if it was right in front of his face, it was so artfully created that it was virtually indistinguishable from the real thing. He pulled the old iron ring mounted on the door. Wouldn't budge. Too much snow and ice accumulation down at the base. He got his trenching tool, and he went to work. It still wouldn't open, so he got out his chopping axe and knocked out a section wide enough for him to peer inside. When he did, he gagged. Not the smell of death, the smell of fetid engine oil. What the hell? He leaned further inside and flipped on his flashlight. No one had been here in 50 years. More likely never. Maybe never. It took him a long time to identify the faux part of the mountain. He chopped away with his ice axe everywhere he could reach or see. Nothing doing. His arms burning with fresh exertion, he dropped his axe to the ground to take a breather and leaned against a heavy boulder. The strangest thing happened. It moved. Chapter 25. He found himself inside a mammoth cave carved out of rock. There was that same smell of engine oil and machinery he'd experienced inside the empty escape tunnel. He whistled aloud. It was nearly the size of a United Airlines hangar at JFK. With his first step forward, 4 beefy characters in black uniforms materialized out of the gloom, all carrying serious assault weapons trained on him. "Morning, gents," he said. "I thought I'd drop by and say hello to the sorcerer. You around? If not, no problem. I could just stop by later." He heard a deep rumble far back in the cave and looked up. Something was moving forward on the rail tracks in the stone floor. Seeing a huge black muzzle emerge, he held his breath. It simply wasn't possible, but there it was. A massive German 88-millimeter cannon. He'd only seen one like it before, and that was in the movie The Guns of Navarone, the one the Germans had set inside the tunnel on top of a mountain. Seriously? A woman made her way down some steel stairs toward him. She had come from a glassed-in office that loomed up over his head. "No need to roll out the heavy artillery," he said. "Hell, I'm not even armed." "Hello," she said sweetly. "You must be Lord Alexander Hawke, correct?" "That's sorry." "We were expecting you, actually. You're a bit late." "Oh, hold on. How on earth did you know that I was coming, if I may be so bold?" "It doesn't matter. We heard of rumor. We hear them all the time. I'm the administrative secretary here, Gisela Bund." "But rumors about me? From whom?" "An old friend of ours in Zurich. But look at you. You're shivering. Let's get you some clean, dry clothes, a nice cup of tea, and a bite to eat. We're all having goulash soup today. Sound good? Then I'll escort you to the office." "Whose office?" "Don't be coy, Lord Hawke.
You know very well whose office. 20 minutes later, well-fed and wearing dry clothes the woman had provided, he was sitting alone in a large paneled office with Persian rugs and walls studded with old masters. Bookcases everywhere, filled with leather-bound collections of authors from Voltaire to Dickens to Hemingway. Hawk had been told by a green-jacketed servant who'd ushered him inside that someone would be with him shortly. "Won't be 10 minutes," he'd said. Antsy, Hawk got up from his chair and walked around a bit. Intensely curious, he went over to the source of the light that filled the whole room. Soaring, floor-to-ceiling windows reached to a 20-foot ceiling, lead-paned and crystal clear. He was wondering if that massive window was such a good idea, especially for someone trying to remain invisible to the world. That was until he saw the massive steel doors to either side, their exterior surfaces sheathed in hyper-realistic fake rock. Doors that would instantly seal tight at the press of a button. Trying unsuccessfully not to be nosy, he surveyed the rest of the surreally beautiful office. He checked the fellow's desk first, a large partner's desk in the style of the famous British architect Robert Adam. There were papers casually lying about, but Hawk chose not to look. But brilliant sunlight streaming through the clouds lit up a shiny object that caught his eye. He bent and looked closer. It was a mounted piece of sculpture about a foot high. He picked it up. It was a Nazi swastika, carved out of a block of highly polished steel. He heard a voice behind him and whirled around as if he'd been caught snooping. "So sorry," he said, putting the artifact back where it belonged, feeling guilty for no reason. "Not at all," the elderly gentleman said. "Sorry I'm tardy. Been a busy day, you know. Please, have a seat." He strode across the carpet and sat in the leather armchair with its back to the spectacular views. Hawk sized him up very quickly. This was no banker. He was a scholar, perhaps a university professor. He had a natural way and a cheery manner, and suggested a facile mind and a quick wit. There was a spark of humor in his blue eyes, fringed with bushy white eyebrows. His head was bald, and he wore a pair of gold eyeglasses that were clearly antique. He was dressed like a banker, however. A three-piece navy suit from a very good tailor, a crisp white shirt, and a blue and white polka-dot bow tie in the manner of Churchill, whom he resembled in an odd way. He sat back, placed his folded hands on the expanse of green leather, and said, "I must say, it's a great pleasure to see you again, Alex. It's been an awfully long time." Alex hid his surprise and said, "See me again?" "Yes, you wouldn't recall. I was just trying to be clever. I led the Swiss army team that brought you down after that awful fall. And later, the one that went up for your grandfather. What a lovely man. We've likely never seen his like again." "Forgive me. This is a bit startling. You two knew each other? We climbed together for years before you were born. Being in a tent with the man on top of a mountain normally brings out the worst in a man, but your dear grandfather and I always had a hell of a time." Hawk laughed at that. "Well, I would like to express my gratitude, but I don't know your name, sir." "Gerhard. Dr. Gerhard Steinhauser," he smiled, "sometimes known, rather foolishly, as the sorcerer." "Well, you're not quite what I expected, Dr. Steinhauser." "Everyone says that, Alex. If you make it to that chair you're using, but everyone who does says exactly that. What do you think of my office? I've grown fond of it." "It's stunning, sir. And I can't help but ask who built all this. It's German, I imagine, based on the 88mm that welcomed me. Not to mention this paperweight I saw you admiring. The man who built this left behind many mementos when he died, and a German. Indeed, a former Nazi Kriegsmarine admiral who defected to Switzerland before the war, someone who dabbled in engineering and architecture. I'm sure you've seen Hitler's Eagle's Nest. Same fellow built both. He constructed all this after defecting to Switzerland in 1936. That monstrous 88 you just saw was smuggled into a train out of Berchtesgaden before people were paying too much attention to the border, you see. His idea was to use it in the event of a German invasion that never happened. And now it's mine, to use as I see fit. Good for nosy neighbors, no? Well, thank you for all your courtesy, sir, both my rescue and now. I don't want to interrupt what is certainly a full agenda for you, but I would appreciate your patience while I ask a few questions.
Oh, fire away, my boy. Fire away.
Chapter 26.
Would you mind if I had one of those cigarettes, Dr. Steinhauser? Not at all. Help yourself. Should have offered. That Silver Eagle is a lighter, by the way. And please don't call me by that pretentious name. Plain old Gert will do. Your grandfather always called me that.
Hawk smiled and said, so, here we are. Thank you for your most gracious hospitality. I'm not sure where to start, and start anywhere you please, Alex. I already know most of it, I'm sure.
Well, then you obviously already know who I work for.
I do. Sir David Truelove, Chief of British Intelligence. MI6, to be precise. You see, I've long had a keen interest in your exploits ever since we lost Sir Richard Hawke. I have an old leather scrapbook with your name on it, to be honest. Le Rossi, Dartmouth Naval College, Royal Navy combat pilot over Baghdad, chairman of Hawke Industries Limited, London's most eligible bachelor sort of thing. And you have a son, Alexei. Congratulations.
That's quite a miracle, but thanks. That will save us a lot of time. So, flash forward, my superior at 6, Sir David, asked me to come to Zurich to investigate some improprieties involving a recent spate of cyber attacks on Her Royal Majesty's Swiss accounts. My colleague, Ambrose Congreve, former chief inspector at Scotland Yard, came as well. Sir David mentioned your name as someone who could be helpful, and
he thinks I'm a scoundrel, doesn't he? A criminal mastermind.
He never said that. He said you were the eminence grise of Swiss banking, living in seclusion. Power behind the throne. He really didn't offer much more than that, clearly. His first priority is to protect the Queen and the royal family, no matter what or who is involved, including you, sir.
Of course, Alex. My role is complex, but it has never been nefarious. I assure you, this infernal moniker that follows me around, sorcerer, implies some kind of evil wizard. But I assure you, I am neither wizard nor evil, nor saint for that matter.
Well, then may I ask what you are?
I'm a peacekeeper. I always have been. The sheriff of Switzerland. There's nothing quite so challenging as keeping a lid on the boiling pot that is Switzerland's role in the world economy. We deal with everyone. Most are honest, but not a few would like to bring this whole elaborate system of doing business built over centuries down. Lately, most of those come from the Arab states. Not all, but a few would like to see our way of doing business, our way of living, cease to exist. Israel has enormous amounts of its treasury here, and so do the sheikhs. Mutually assured financial destruction, so to speak.
You're the guardian, then, the keeper of the flame.
Oh, you could say that. The Chinese and the Russians are even more difficult these last few years. Amazing cyber weapons, all aimed at a precious few free countries. Western Europe, Britain, and the United States and their allies.
Would you say that Russia and China are the source of the recent attacks on Her Majesty? Not to mention Britain herself?
I certainly would. Containing those two vipers takes up the majority of my allotted time. These events you're seeing involving the assets of the royal family and Her Majesty's government are the most troubling at this moment.
Any hope of putting a stop to them?
Indeed, a great deal of hope. I'm in the process of hiring the very best and the brightest computer scientists from around the world and bringing them here to work for us. Students from China, Russia, and North Korea as well. All very hush-hush, as your grandfather used to say. But yes, these efforts are yielding successes. Because of my affection for the Queen, I have also taken responsibility for leading a forensic cyber threat team dedicated solely to Her Majesty's financial protection.
Hawk leaned forward, excited. Is this something I can bring back to MI6? Your personal involvement with settling the Queen's affairs for Sir David's ears only? Steinhauser thought about it for a long moment.
Please have Sir David call me about it when you get back to London, Alex. Tell him that I'll discuss that subject with him. Perhaps I'll invite him here for a few days.
Thank you.
He will be vastly relieved to hear. The Queen, however, is not to hear of this, no matter what. Tell him that. Too many people in Buckingham Palace I'd like not to hear about this.
Of course. And there's another matter I'd like to discuss. The bizarre murder of a Credit Suisse banker just returned from London. We found his corpse just below this location.
Leo Herman. I'm glad he was found before he was buried beneath the ice. Leo's death was no murder, Alex. It was suicide. Leo, although 30 years younger than I, was a close friend of mine. But he caused me worry. I had him followed in London. He met with some very unsavory characters at the Connaught Grill. Suspects involved with criminal events we've been speaking of. Leo had been selling highly classified information regarding my work for Her Majesty. I suspected him for quite some time. The meeting in London was Leo's undoing. I'm so sorry about all this. Can you tell me about the circumstances surrounding his death? My friend, Chief Inspector Congreve, finds himself in a highly unusual situation.
Which is? Perplexed. For perhaps the first time ever.
I know your friend Congreve by reputation only. I'll be happy to tell you if it will help you put his mind at ease, Alex. Here's what happened. I called Leo at the Connaught in London that night and told him I needed to see him here, in my office, immediately. The next day. I'm sure he suspected the worst, but what choice did he have? He arrived late the next morning, looking haggard and depressed. Desperate, I would say. He was in tears. His life was over, Bock said. Well, I suppose it was. He had admitted everything to his wife. She was leaving him, taking the two children, moving back to Sweden to be near her family. There was really nothing more to say at that point. I picked up the phone to call my pilot, whose helicopter was in a holding pattern, waiting to return for the pickup. Leo got up, said thanks for my kindness, and left. My secretary said he'd gone outside to wait for the helo on the ledge. He didn't wait. When the pilot arrived, Leo wasn't there.
Dr. Steinhauser suggested taking Alex on a tour of the vast mountain complex, honeycombed with brightly lit tunnels and passages leading who knows where, banks of gleaming stainless steel elevators providing service from the secret underwater entrance near the bottom of Lake Zurich. They toured the private residence, 3 floors with interiors that resembled the Duke of Devonshire's historic country home at Chatsworth. A grand, sweeping staircase joined the floors, which boasted the same panoramic views as Steinhauser's magnificent office. There were also separate guest quarters built inside, a small peak of a lower mountain. Hawk and his host reached them by a lengthy underground tunnel with a small tram, running in both directions on a single track.
"I call this house Das Kleinenberg," he said.
"Little peak," Hawk said, smiling.
"Good for you, Alex. Some of the German I taught you stuck."
As they strolled down Little Peak's wide corridors and peeked into various guest rooms, sunrooms, and a paneled reading room, Hawk, who was rarely impressed, found himself full of wonder.
"Small and self-contained, more rustic and to me more appealing," Steinhauser said. "Here we are. I wanted you to see this room. Leo Herman's room. I haven't touched it since his death. I was deeply saddened by the pictures of his wife and children in happier times."
"May I have a look inside?" Alex said. There were 2 worn leather armchairs facing the window, and the 2 men sat down. Alex looked around at the mementos from a life now lost.
"I can see why it makes you sad," he said. "When a trusted friend betrays you, it is always deeply disheartening. Especially when the betrayal is the result of matters far beyond their control. Leo was a student of mine when I taught economics at New College, Oxford. Brilliant boy, always was. Hired by both Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley in New York. Shot to the top of both and moved back to Zurich, happy for all anyone knew. I quickly hired him and put him to work. There were problems as time went by, sketchy attendance, padded expense accounts, complaints from subordinates, you know how it is. There were rumors that his wife was driving him to make more and more money. The well-known never-enough type of spouse. Leo started drinking heavily, too, then stealing to try to keep her happy. And finally, selling information. That's the end of that sad story. I'm so sorry. Thank you. Dr. Steinhauser said, rising from his chair. Alex, it's been marvelous connecting with you after all these years. I dearly hope you will allow me to continue our new friendship. It's gone 8 o'clock. Won't you join my daughter and me for a light supper? I can arrange to have my pilot statue from the ledge at 9. Sound good to you? Sounds wonderful, sir. I can't thank you enough for what you did for me and my grandfather. And all you're doing now, not only for me personally, but for my queen and country as well. Well, I'm sure Sir David will put the full resources of MI6 at your disposal going forward. And if there's anything I can do personally that might help your investigation, just let me know. They took a smooth and silent tram ride back to Dr. Steinhauser's residence. After a minute, Steinhauser broke the silence. "There is one thing you might do for me," Dr. Steinhauser said. "Anything, sir?" "I wasn't going to mention it because I did not know how helpful it might be, and..." "Please tell me. I can use all the help I can get at the moment, sir." "Very well. Recently, since your arrival in Zurich, the hacking attacks on your personal accounts have increased dramatically. It's the Russians on the receiving end, and they're the worst, as you well know. I cannot prove it yet, but someone living here in Zurich seems to be working with Moscow, hacking into your less protected assets." "Well, that's certainly a big step in the right direction, my friend. Ambrose will be delighted to know that. Do you know who it is? Just give me a name, and MI6 will personally remove this chap from our list of worries, permanently. Who the hell is it, Dr. Steinhauser?" "Does the name Baron Wolfgang von Stucker ring a bell, Alex?" Hawks stiffened at the name, shocked. "You've got to be joking. He's the one helping us solve the case. And by the way, what the hell does he have against me?" Hawk asked angrily. "Rumors are there's a woman involved, Alex." Epilogue. De Hohenzollern. "More champagne, darling?" "Just a splash, Alex." No, stop," Sigrid cried. Ambrose Congreve sat back and smiled at the two of them. He could not remember seeing his old friend so happy, at least not in a very long time. All three of them had dressed to the nines for their Christmas Eve dinner. Hawk and Ambrose resplendent in black tie. Sigrid, radiant in a plunging sequined gown of bright Christmas red. Tomorrow morning, Ambrose and Alex would board Hawk's Gulfstream for the short flight back to London. But tonight, the three friends celebrated where it all began. The Hohenzollern. All the festive arrangements had been made in secret. Sigrid collaborated with her old co-conspirator in the planning. The two had reserved the small private dining room on the second floor. The hand-hewn wooden room was a masterpiece of 19th-century Austrian carpentry. It had a stone fireplace and leaded-paned windows with a view of the bustling town square below, and the light snow falling softly on this happy Christmas Eve. Best of all, a glorious Christmas tree stood in the corner, the top branches of the dark green fir brushed against the vaulted ceiling. All were decorated with red wooden ornaments, and lighted candles gave the place a golden glow. There were two gifts beneath the tree, one each for Ambrose and Alex. Laughter was mixed with tying up a few loose ends from the week. Wolfie had been arrested by the Staatspolizei, based on hard evidence supplied by an anonymous source. The case had exploded, reverberating across front pages on both sides of the Atlantic.
MI6 and CIA were jointly looking into von Stuttgart's criminal networks in both Moscow and Beijing.